Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. The recent violent demonstrations in Charlottesville, Virginia, are yet another reminder that America is divided. It seems as if the battles we fought 150 years ago still smolder. Marching against the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue, torch-wielding white supremacists met with an angry, animated counterprotest. Violence broke out. A woman was murdered and two police officers were killed in the service of trying to maintain peace and order in the city. When we started this podcast, we thought that the emotional battles over how our nation processes the aftermath of the Civil War and the legacy of the Confederacy would be good material for an episode. And we've produced two episodes on this subject, both of which were spurred by a backlash from local government's decision to remove Confederate monuments and symbols. We released our episode In Dixieland, I'll Take My Stand, just after then South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley announced that the Confederate battle flag would no longer be flown over the state capitol. Her announcement came after Dylann Roof massacred nine worshipers at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Roof, a self-declared white supremacist, posted selfies with the Confederate flag on social media. And then my colleagues, Rupa Goganeni and Mike Oniego, filed a report for us from New Orleans right at the time that Mayor Mitchell Andrew proposed taking down Confederate statues in the Big Easy. Quite frankly, I thought that we were done with this topic for a while. But this Charlottesville tragedy reminds us that people in our country are not going to let these relics of the Confederacy go gently into that good night. When we heard about Charlottesville, we thought it might make sense to revisit the Confederate Reckoning program that Mike and Rupa made for us back in 2015. Their piece really gets to the arguments that pit those for and against the statue's removal. As we live through another chapter of this perpetual Us and Them rift that stems from our unfinished business regarding slavery and race relations, it makes me wonder, will the Civil War ever be over? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them. It's the podcast where we tell stories from America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. Today, a Confederate reckoning. Reporters Mike Oniego and Rupa Goganeni spent several weeks in New Orleans talking with residents about the city's Confederate monuments. So, I think of you two as foreign reporters. You both do work from Africa for outlets like Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. So, what brought you to New Orleans?
Right. We normally report in Africa, where we cover conflicts in Somalia and in Sudan. But over the past year, we kept seeing reports of the upheaval at home in the States, from the Ferguson riots to Baltimore to Eric Garner, and definitely the massacre in Charleston. And these symbols of the Confederacy kept popping up.
Yeah, and we were kind of dumbfounded by it, to be honest. You know, I'm from Chicago, and I don't think I'd ever thought about the Civil War outside of social studies class. You know, and suddenly there are all these people waving flags and defending a heritage that, to me, looks outright racist.
I'm from West Virginia, and so I was more used to the flag. I always thought of it as rooting for the underdog. But everything that was going on in the States was making me rethink that. You know, watching people in South Carolina and across the South fight tooth and nail to keep the symbols up, it made the whole thing seem so much bigger. And we were curious why the Civil War, which ended 150 years ago, is still so contested.
So you've been covering these civil wars abroad, and it seemed like there's sort of a civil war still going on here at home. Is that what brought you back?
Well, I've been a journalist for several years, but in all those years, I've never actually reported from America, which is my home. And these events were unfolding, and we were looking at them from the perspective of foreign correspondents in our own country. And so we thought it'd be important to be part of it.
Why New Orleans?
Well, you know, it seemed from the outside that New Orleans is one of those places where history is really alive. Historic sites there are a big draw for tourists. People go on tours of the old plantation houses and on French Quarter tours. But we found out that some people felt like those tours had been really whitewashed.
Yeah, and also this was right after South Carolina was talking about taking down its Confederate symbols because of the shooting in Charleston. You know, you talked about that on your show. And not long after that, the mayor of New Orleans called on the city to take down its own Confederate symbols.
And so I began to envision myself as an African-American man driving down the street with my little girl behind me, approaching Lee Circle, and her saying, "Hey, Daddy, that's a really nice statue. What is that? It's so pretty." I said, "Well, honey, that's a General Lee."
So here he's talking about a 60-foot statue of Robert E. Lee that's in downtown New Orleans.
I think today is the day to start to have the discussion about what we're going to put there to celebrate our 300th anniversary.
So this prompted a huge backlash across the state. And as we watched this reaction, we were really curious as to who those people were, who was so willing to fight for these statues that many people found offensive. And so we talked about going home to the States and kind of being these foreign correspondents, but on our own soil.
I actually didn't want to go. As a black person, I've always kind of had this irrational fear about the South, and I'd never really been down there. I studied the Civil War in school as this thing of the past, you know, this closed book that we didn't return to. But this time I was drawn in by how the Confederacy and the Civil War had just endured. And I could not fathom how it was still possible. So with this going on, it just kind of felt important to go down there and check it out.
And we should probably warn folks, there's some language in this story that some people might find offensive.
We arrived in a sultry, sleepy New Orleans as the summer ended.
New Orleans driving.
In late August, things get too hot for words.
I guess you are allowed to drive on the tracks.
Oh.
It almost felt like Sudan or Somalia. The real New Orleans is much grittier than we'd imagined. The tree-lined, cobbled, and colorful boulevards exist, but much more of the city is cracked pavement, power lines, and looming expressways, port cranes, and warehouses. It's disappointing at first, but it grows on you, and the town begins to feel more like a real city, not just some Disney fairy tale. New Orleans is 300 years old, and you can feel all of those 300 years in it as you drive. There are the flags, French, Spanish, Independent, Louisiana, and Confederate, all the former owners of this territory. But the 4 years of the Confederacy loom large.
Two of the city's most prominent statues honor Confederate generals P.G.T. Beauregard and Robert E. Lee. Another, on a quaint mid-city boulevard, honors Confederate President Jefferson Davis. The fourth, and by far the strangest, is called the Liberty Monument, and it commemorates the battle waged by a group called the White League against integration after the Civil War. Maybe there is reason to love those statues, and perhaps the gallantry of that time. We thought it would only be fair to try and understand why some people cared so much. We didn't have to wait long for our chance. The Sons of Confederate Veterans, Louisiana Division, had organized a rally at Lee Circle.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Well, let's go. I guess I'm just gonna try to be super nice. If they don't wanna talk, I'll just kinda hang around and watch.
It was a sweltering Thursday afternoon,
As we approached Lee's Circle, my heart started pounding. There were dozens of white Southerners waving Confederate flags. It barely seemed real. I cursed myself. What was I doing here? Why did I need to walk into this crowd and point a microphone at them? Had I forgotten that I was black? I'd reported in Somalia and Iraq, but I really didn't want to be in New Orleans at that moment.
Robert Bonner, sir.
Nice Robert?
Bonner.
Bonner, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Mike Onyego.
Mike.
This is Rupa.
Hey, Rupa. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
It turns out the ralliers were actually pretty friendly. They shook our hands and welcomed us enthusiastically and offered us water bottles and were the embodiment of so-called Southern hospitality. But things got weird almost immediately. We started speaking to Robert Bonner. He seemed to be one of the leaders. Our conversation turned pretty quickly to the Confederate flag. He wanted us to know that the flag was not a racist symbol and that the people at the rally weren't racists.
We want everybody to realize this is heritage, not hate.
What do you say to the people who are offended by it? I mean, what would you say?
Most of the time, you can't get a word in edgewise.
Sure.
If they're offended, I ask them, you know, God loves you just as much as he does me. And if you're willing to listen to what I have to say, okay, please listen. My family owned slaves, okay? They stayed with my family till the 1950s. They took on my last name, the Bonner name. They loved the family. They were treated as family. But the worst thing that ever happened in this country was slavery.
That was the first time someone had ever told me to my face that slavery wasn't as bad as it was made out to be. But it would happen again and again as the days and weeks unfolded. I was stunned. I let Bonner rejoin the others to kick off the rally. It didn't start well. Cars driving past the circle were honking. Black and white New Orleanians shouted and presented middle fingers to the Confederate supporters.
Fuck you too!
At the time, polls were showing that most black Americans see the Confederate flag as a symbol of racism. But most white Americans told pollsters they saw it as a symbol of Southern pride. That's what Steve Alvarez said at the rally. He's a lieutenant commander in the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Slavery was under the federal government since colonial times. It was only underneath the Confederate battle flag for 4 or 5 years. I think the problem is they haven't studied history enough to know about the whole event of the Civil War. There were black brothers that fought alongside of the white Confederacy. At Shiloh, they had 600.
One by one, supporters of Lee and the monuments came up to give speeches.
We are America. And the Civil War is a major point of American history. If you trash the Civil War, you trash everything since then.
Shall we dishonor them because someone's offended? I'm offended by a lot of stuff in life, but I simply deal with it and move on. This statue should not come down, and it will be over my dead body.
Aside from us, there were only two people of color in the audience. One was a guy who we found out later was named Russell Robinson. The ralliers were standing at the base of the Lee statue, surrounded by Confederate flags, while onlookers watched from the steps leading to the monument. Robinson stood at the top of the steps, just 5 feet from the flag bearers, shaking his head in disagreement. When one person spoke about black soldiers serving the Confederate Army, he muttered, "by force." He occasionally raised his fist in a black power salute. Some people jeered quietly, others ignored him. Eventually, Steve Alvarez turned to him and offered him the chance to speak.
Would you like a chance to speak?
You're a bunch of liars and you're a bunch of thieves. You're a bunch of murderers. If you want to keep this shit up, right here,
that shit is.
Robinson was barely able to speak before the ralliers cut in. They yelled that he needed to know his history. Alvarez tried, but he couldn't keep the crowd under control. One man said Robinson should be grateful that he hadn't starved to death in Africa. Others started shouting about slavery.
What you say about slavery?
Nothing. Your ancestors sold your other ancestors into slavery.
Why? Because y'all came over with guns.
All right. Came over with guns.
Steve Alvarez jumped in again.
I don't know of one town that you can go to in the United States, even a little farm, corner, grocery, gas station, that's it, that doesn't have a Martin Luther King Drive, Boulevard, or street. So you, that's what y'all, that's yours, and we would not ask you to take that down. We just don't want the black people to say that we have to take ours down because it offends them. That we telling the black community are asking them to study. You and your grandfather, ancestors, were slaves, like, you know, most black that came here, because that was what it existed then. But they also...
Alvarez, Bonner, and so many other supporters of the flag saw a different Southern history than any we had ever heard. One where blacks and whites were not enemies, but allies against the marauding North. It was personal and valiant.
One more thing I'd like to say, and I hope everybody joins in with me. I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there and I've forgotten. Look away, look away.
In the end, only about 30 people showed up for the rally. They probably didn't represent the mainstream, and most people probably don't believe their version of history. But driving around New Orleans, it's obvious that their version isn't that fringe. With all the glorious memorials to the Confederacy and streets named after Confederate heroes and museums celebrating that period, it's easy to see how people living here might have distorted views of history. In a city that is majority black, the narrative of old New Orleans is very, very white.
We went to meet a man named Malcolm Suber. Malcolm is a longtime activist and union organizer, and for years, Malcolm has been giving paid tours called Hidden History. He uses them to change perceptions about New Orleans and the Old South.
According to the official tours in the city, New Orleans was a great place in the 1840s, antebellum period. And that was the pinnacle of their civilization, and that was destroyed by the Civil War. That's their narrative. And so,
whose narrative?
The official tour guides in the city. That's their narrative. It's a Confederate story. It's a love affair of the Confederacy. And that's the thing that they want to glorify. They tell you about these houses were built by this architect, that architect, blah blah blah. But what they don't tell you is how is it that this family had money to do that?
We took Malcolm up on his offer to see his tour of New Orleans' most famous attraction, the French Quarter.
Now, another interesting feature about New Orleans is you see this pink building here? That is a slave quarter.
We met him on a quiet Monday morning. Bar owners were washing the streets down after another raucous New Orleans weekend. It was too early to be hot, and the sun was just peeking through the narrow cobbled alleys. The pastel houses were dripping with Spanish moss and wisteria. We passed down old streets named Rampart, Burgundy, Dauphine, and Bourbon. It was everything you expected from old New Orleans.
And what makes New Orleans kind of unique in the history of enslavement of the African people is what's interesting, of course, is though, even though the church ordained that the Africans be Christianized, become Catholic, their Catholicism didn't stop them from being enslaved. So there was a moral contradiction from the very beginning.
But Malcolm's tour was intense. Most of the tours in and around New Orleans barely mentioned slavery. Only one of the famous plantation tours, the Whitney Museum, discusses it. But Malcolm discussed it nonstop. It was a stark illustration of how much we ignore this painful part of our history. And he didn't want to talk about the usual tourist sites either.
And I noticed, I just saw a plaque. It looks like we just passed by the place where Napoleon was offered the...
But anyway, this is what I want to show you.
It was where Napoleon Bonaparte was offered refuge after being ousted in 1821. Any other French Quarter tour would definitely have mentioned it.
The French Quarter is a memorial to white supremacy.
When you walk around New Orleans with Malcolm, you see that history is not just a matter of facts, but choosing your facts. Malcolm was focused squarely on the painful African-American experience in the city, and he pulled no punches, even for universally beloved New Orleans institutions.
All right, We're back in Armstrong Park. Now, these are some sculptures that have been added since 2010.
The sculptures depict the musicians of the famous second line parades. There are trumpeters, trombone players, and drummers marching in a row.
And in New Orleans, 39 weeks a year, we have a second line parade.
The impromptu street celebrations have their roots in the city's black jazz funerals.
My interpretation is that the rich white people have said, Sunday afternoon is your time. Y'all can go out there and have cut up and have a good time as long as you be at work on Monday morning.
Malcolm here is echoing the Code Noir, the French law that allowed slaves to take Sundays off. We were standing next to Congo Square, the same square where many New Orleans slaves would come on those Sundays to play traditional African music.
That's where that is.
You know, Malcolm, you're kind of depressing guy. You're talking about everything that everyone comes to New Orleans for.
I mean, I'm not opposed to people having a good time, but I think a good time sometimes masks the misery. Many times you get a smile and a bow and a scrape and you think people are all right, but if you really scratch the surface and ask them how they were really doing, they're not doing so well. This is one of the poorest cities in the country. Of the 300 largest cities in this country, this has the largest gap of income. And so our people are poor. And because we're so poor, we lead the country in incarceration. And these are the things that we should be addressing. And you're spending your time getting ready for your annual parade.
Malcolm is part of the coalition that wants the Confederate statues taken down. He had the weary face of a man who'd been fighting this fight all his life. And he had been. We asked him for his take on the monument debate.
When the white folks put that shit up, they didn't confer with black folks. They just put them up because that's who they wanted to honor. So our position is take them all down, take them down now, and we don't need the discussion. And they'll just have to live with it and learn to live with it. You know.
We now had two competing versions of history and new questions about race and representation. We drove north to Monroe, Louisiana, to meet with Thomas Taylor, the head of the Louisiana Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, or SCV. Their members are some of the men you see reenacting Civil War battles, and also some of those we met waving Confederate flags at Lee Circle. Thomas Taylor keeps active on social media. He distributes talking points on the group's Facebook page to help members explain why Confederate monuments should stay, or why the flags do not represent hatred or white supremacy.
Rupa thought we should meet him, but I wasn't exactly thrilled by the idea of driving into rural Louisiana to meet the state's chief Confederate, but I agreed. We called and, to my surprise, he agreed to meet us. Monroe is an old cotton town nestled onto the east side of the Ouachita River. In the old days, cotton would come in from the plantations, and they'd ship it down the river to New Orleans. From there, the cotton kingpins would send it to all corners of the earth. The old Monroe is still there, with wide streets and graying stone buildings. But the newer section is the more standard Kmart and chain store suburban south. It's where Duck Dynasty takes place.
Thomas Taylor, I'm the Louisiana Division Commander for the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Thomas Taylor is an affable, middle-aged guy with flowing white hair. We met him at the public library. He came in wearing his SCV polo with its Confederate flag emblem, and he explained to us that he was carrying a little pistol for protection, as he always did. We tried to understand why the Civil War played such a large part in his life.
I've always felt a kinship with the people back then, you know. Of course, y'all are younger, so you wouldn't. Times have changed in the last 50 years so much. Heck, back when I was a kid, there used to be a Sears catalog come out twice a year. And then it was, they always had a picture of a kid, two kids. One of them was wearing a Confederate uniform, one was wearing a federal uniform, and I wanted one of those Confederate uniforms so bad I couldn't stand it.
For Taylor, it wasn't necessarily about correcting history. The Confederacy was a connection to his past. But it was still complicated. The legacy of the Confederacy is tied to the legacy of slavery. And even Taylor was trying to make sense of it.
Have you read the slave narratives?
Some of them, yeah.
Why don't they use those? Why don't the opposition use those today? Because a whole lot of them, not all of them, because nothing's 100%, a whole lot of them said, it wasn't so bad. And they don't want that getting out there. It's just like, you know, I can say any institution can be abused and will be abused, any of them. And the institution of slavery, the people were abused, not all of them. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that it's right or moral or anything. I'm telling you the way they thought.
Why are we, you know, because some people have made this argument as well, and I just wonder why people even engage in this specific part of it, because, you know, in this debate and in this country, like, this is America, freedom is all. And whether or not they're well treated, they didn't have their freedom, so, like, why would we even engage in this line of, you know?
Because that was the thinking of the day, you know? And
it's not the talk like was strange in more ways than one. It turned out that Taylor saw Confederates as victims of discrimination. He described a debate he once had with a member of the NAACP.
The lady from the NAACP, all she wanted to talk about is her feelings. Well, that's great. In her opening statement, she told me that if she saw a white man in a pickup truck with a Confederate flag on his truck, then I know who he is. No, you don't. Like I told her, I'm sitting here with a tie loaded with battle flags. And you don't know one thing about me. You don't know anything about the way I think. But you've labeled that guy, and it's kind of like a racial profiling thing. You know who that man is, don't you? And that makes you a bigot. I don't think she's ever been called a bigot before, but she has now, so there you go. I can say a whole lot of things because I've done a whole lot of reading. But when a young person, a young black person, goes out there on that street today, he sees that Confederate battle flag. He sees a symbol of hatred and slavery. And why is that? It's because somebody told him that. He's been told that from the time he was a little guy.
I didn't agree with many of Thomas Taylor's truths, but did that matter? Couldn't he have his history so long as it didn't get in the way of anyone else's?
After a short break, more of Mike and Rupa's reporting from New Orleans on the city's monuments honoring the Confederacy. I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
Like Confederate symbols, brand. Basically. Okay. The flag, the statues.
Okay. Whenever I see it, it upsets me because I know what it means, and they know what it means.
That's Theo, a student from Grambling State, a historically black university 45 minutes from where we met Thomas Taylor.
I mean, you feel that way because you're raised that way. It's in your household. You know what I mean? You look to those who you've mimicked after all these years, and that's usually a father, your mother. They mimic the grandfather, you know, and they make sure that their children learn from that.
We met Theo and his friend Keith through an acquaintance. We got together at a bar. School was out for the summer, so most of their friends weren't around. It was the kind of place that did not make me miss college. Jello shots, top 40, grinding. It was also entirely white, except for the four of us. It was a feeling so familiar that I might not have even noticed had we not been reporting this story. Theo asked what we were working on. I told him, and he wanted to talk. We all moved to the car so we could get away from the loud music.
Let me ask a question. What advice would you give me? I mean, you know me, I'm from Chicago. I'm not from the South. I don't know the South. What do I need to know about Ruston? And I'm black.
You need to know that whenever you're doing in close contact with a white person who is racist, you won't know initially, of course, but you'll know they're racist by, like I said, case in point, in the Walmart, whenever I gave my customers change, or whenever they gave me change, they would sit on the counter and do this, because they didn't want to touch, and whenever we reached at the same time, they kind of dash back, pick up my change, please. I'm like, okay, what can I say? Like, they're in your face in Northern Louisiana. They're in your face.
All right.
They're in your face.
All right.
I've had customers, because I did the ear piercings in Walmart also. I have customers, they're always white, who didn't want me to do their ear piercings simply because they look at my profile. Oh, he can't do that. He can't do something so tedious. You know, you can't do something like that. He's going to fuck it up. He requests Michelle, who's a white woman, and I knew more than she did, and she would always say that.
We hadn't noticed, but even here at the bar, things weren't quite so friendly. Theo pointed something out to Keith.
I want to ask you this from the moment we got in there. When you paid your money, what did that guy say to you when you gave your money?
He told me to tuck my chain in.
And then what did he say? Because I don't think you heard him.
I ain't heard it.
He said, you're a brave nigga. That's what he told you. I swear to God. He said, oh, you're a brave nigga. I swear to God.
I haven't been drinking.
But you didn't hear him. You kind of went on. You was already in motion. You was already in motion to the left, to the entry. I looked at him. I gave him the look.
God, I don't think he said that.
I know this.
I'm not going to take away what you're saying, but what I'm saying, I didn't hear him to say that.
Why do you think he asked you to tuck his chain in?
Because everybody got their chain tucked in there. I don't know.
What does that mean? Why does that matter?
I don't even know. I haven't been here in years.
Who? Every rule they have is geared toward the African American. Mm-hmm. I could wear my hat backwards. My hats are just typical baseball hats that everybody wears. If it's backwards, turn it forward. But when I get in there, every guy has their hat backwards. What's the point in that? Like, why? I can't come in with that? I've been told to take my hat off. Can't wear a white shirt. Got guys in there wearing that. But they're also gonna have a belt buckle on, the big belt buckle on, the cowboy boots. That's fine to them. That's fine. They profile you.
Do you guys ever feel like you just want to move?
Yes. And
like,
yeah, of course.
I'm not staying here.
There are two Louisianas, depending on who you are and where you're standing. Thomas Taylor's version of history seemed to deny the racism and violence of the past. Issues that still haunt people like Keith and Theo today. Listening to them, I began to realize that though I'm not white, I still couldn't fully understand what it meant to be black in this place. That we were all, in some ways, ignorant to the experience of others. As we left, Keith pulled me aside. He told me that ever since watching Slumdog Millionaire, he's always wanted to meet an Indian girl. He tried some pickup lines in broken Hindi. I rolled my eyes, and we both laughed. The next day, we headed back to New Orleans.
Where am I going?
Right.
We wanted to find some of the other voices in the Confederate camp. We got in touch with Jason Sutton. He calls himself a historical preservationist. We first met Jason at the Lee Circle rally. He was a few decades younger than most people there, and he wasn't holding a Confederate flag. We caught up with him again at a bar on Jefferson Davis Parkway. Across from the bar was a statue of Davis, one arm resting on a Greek column, the other raised outward. Jason couldn't believe this debate about monuments, race, and slavery was even happening.
Frankly, up until about 6 weeks ago, you really didn't hear anything about this, short of the odd guy that would come out here and spray something on this monument, the one right in front of us. You never heard hide nor hair of this. From white people, black people, Creole people, anybody. The only people you ever heard really talking about were tourists, asking, where are these monuments? Mm-hmm. You know, where's Lee Circle at?
Yeah.
You know, just keep walking, you follow the tracks, you know.
But
that's a big thing, because it wasn't a problem until Landrieu decided to light this very incendiary fuse. I think we can all agree. And now, suddenly, it's a problem. And frankly, it's still only a problem for a very small minority of people.
Yeah.
Basically, they're saying, however they want to phrase it, they're saying anything Confederate is offensive. My position is, prove it.
But how do you prove a feeling?
Tell me what they mean to you and how they're affecting your life so oppressively. They can't point to anything concrete. Because they're not oppressed by them.
Okay, so what would you say to a black man who is walking his young black daughter by?
Yeah, that story is a cock and bull story.
I mean, don't kids ask what things are all the time?
Well, yeah, but it didn't happen with this. The Confederate monument is like 120 feet in the air. adults can't even hardly see the damn thing. Okay. A 6 or 7 year old kid not only couldn't see it, they're not surely not going to ask who the hell it is if they can't see it. That's why I say the whole story is a load.
Fine, Jefferson Davis, right in front of us. Why is he? Why am I looking at him? Why is he made of stone? And why is he on this street corner?
Well. How should you describe to the child, this incredibly inquisitive child that doesn't exist? I mean, kid, you're giving children a lot of credit here.
This is how Jason argued. He never really answered the question.
And this is an honor to a man who stood for his what he believed in, and he believed in keeping the South as an agrarian society with slave labor, and they chose to secede from the Union. And
then, as it always seemed to, the conversation turned to slavery.
Let's look at this from the context of its time frame. Blacks also owned slaves in New Orleans. There were 10,000 blacks that owned 20,000 slaves. Nobody loves, everyone rolls their eyes at that. Nobody wants to talk about that. Why not? Why is that such a non-issue for people?
Many blacks owned slaves because many states in the Union literally made freeing slaves illegal. So many people bought their wives and owned them so that they could. I don't honestly know what to say. Like, you want to laugh at it, but like that's documented.
Well, so I'm sure some of them were, but the 10,000 these were free men of color who owned slaves here in New Orleans.
Bought their wives so they could live with them. I don't.
No. 10,000. No, they owned slaves, man. Black people owned plantations in this state.
Black people owned slaves before white
people. I can take you to a black-owned plantation.
Totally
I can take you to a black-owned plantation tomorrow. I mean, the bottom line is it exists. I don't have to physically bring you there.
Jason wouldn't actually take us, but we did go the next day. The plantation he sent us to did not have black slave owners. The conversation went on like this for hours. We tried to listen, but at times it got hard. Jason felt obstinate.
And you never hear that story.
Eventually, our conversation attracted the attention of neighboring tables, the bouncers, passersby, and we had a dozen people talking about race in America. One guy was named Marcelino. He had moved to the United States from Mozambique 6 years ago.
So Mozambique had a very long civil war, and it's over now. How do people remember it?
We don't talk about that war no more. We don't, because we know like was a lot of pain involved, a lot of people die. If we talk, will bring us more sadness, and nobody want to talk about it. And I believe most of the black people here, they're part of the problem, because all they do just complain. It's like, okay, it was done, wasn't fair, but what you gonna do? You gonna go back to the past and change? You know what the statue's gonna do? The statue's gonna like, it's gonna hire you, it's gonna give you a job, it's gonna pay you salary, the statue's gonna send you to school.
Your entry into this world is very, the entry point is different, right?
Yes.
The way that you're experiencing all of this is as an immigrant.
He doesn't have to be from New Orleans to have an opinion on Confederate monuments.
No, but I'm just saying, I think it's important to make a distinction between your experience as a black person here and an African American, right?
Most of them, they didn't even have that experience.
What do you mean?
They just talk.
That and everything he said is fucking brilliant.
Jason loved Marcelino. He seemed to reinforce his points and was a black man, which somehow gave them more weight. Mike, on the other hand, did not love Marcelino. I had to pull Mike away from a debate that would have lasted until dawn. The enormity of the discussion and all of its endless digressions was starting to weigh on us. Mike begrudgingly shook everyone's hand and got in the car. I secretly recorded him as we drove off.
That guy, he knows what colonialism looks like. He knows that. And he can't see it here? Are you kidding me? Black people are all good because it's America? Are you fucking kidding me? My dad never thought that ever. I can't believe it. How dare you tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about? You just got here a fucking minute ago.
He's been here 6 years.
I don't give a shit. That's a minute ago.
The constant debate about race, history, and slavery were taking their toll, starting to sink in and feel personal. Rupa and I talked about it the next morning.
I just feel deflated. I just feel like there's no point in talking about it anymore. because nothing is going to change. People don't want to change or move forward. And so I'm just really sad.
We decided to press on, but only because we'd already set up our meetings. It was too late to cancel.
Matter of fact, let's see, let me show you.
We had heard of a woman named Murtis who found an abandoned slave cemetery in the woods of St. Helena Parish, near Baton Rouge.
Right here.
We paid her a visit at home.
People would say, that's a little weird, because I go in the cemeteries by myself. But, I have this thing, and my dad told me, it's not the dead you have to watch. It's the living. The dead not going to do you anything.
Murtis had been cleaning up cemeteries for years. Sometimes she got help from inmates from the local jail. She first learned of the slave cemetery in 2002. Her own ancestors were slaves in the parish, and she believed they could have been buried there.
But here's the one that's cleaning up the slave cemetery, right here. Because I had the news people, and now he's a newsman.
On the kitchen table, she'd set up several albums and poster boards of photos from the slave cemetery. All of the walls in her home were covered in photographs. Murtis was clearly another kind of preservationist.
That's the Clinton Cemetery. This is the... You see me with all my animals here.
This is a picture of Murtis wearing a blue shirt surrounded by seven inmates in orange jumpsuits.
Yeah.
What did it look like when you first got... Did it look like anything was there?
Oh.
Oh, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
So, right there. No.
Yeah. Just looks like a forest.
It's no, You pass through there, you will never know that it was a slave cemetery.
You got to it right in time, I guess.
Murtis got hold of a thermoheat imaging device that could show where Earth had been disturbed. The process of burying bodies left air pockets that made the ground temperature slightly warmer. With the device, she could see the outlines of graves. They were organized in rows.
They were marking with red flags. And I turned around and I saw rows. You know? And it was absolutely perfect of what those graves were. Wow. It was the most moving thing that anybody could witness with that. If you had seen it before, like, you know, with all that stuff, you would never know. We thought that we were going by the impressions and all. And we thought that maybe it was 18, everybody was saying, nobody was saying, no, 82, that's for sure. And so I went to one of the dealers on Florida Boulevard, and he donated me 82 stones, about 4 feet high, and we were able to put enough in the ground and above the ground that they will not be moved for a long, 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 long time.
Why was it important for you to mark them?
Because I didn't want it to ever fall back and nobody would know it's there for preservation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the only way I knew to preserve it, because no one's going to go in and dig up 82 stones. So it's going to be there for quite a while.
It's about an uncomfortable and difficult period in American history. How did people in the community feel?
I didn't really test the community.
Yeah.
Or really didn't. That was the last thing on my mind. Yeah. It is what it is. That's the way I think. And I mean, it wasn't important to me whether they liked it or not. It happened. Now, I don't go around faulting people, but because it happened, to me, it just was. But we must, we can't just brush it under the rug, because it is history. I feel like these people deserve to be remembered in some kind of way. We probably would never know their names or anything, but we will know that they were here on this earth.
Murtis seemed tired. She was 70 years old and was not sure who would maintain the cemetery after she passed on. She gave us directions to the site, to pass the older building that used to be a nightclub, that other big building with nothing inside, and a man who sells funny stuff. We got lost. But after a few calls back to Murtis, we finally found the spot.
Are we here?
I think we're here.
When we arrived, we almost didn't see the cemetery, but there it was.
This one is harder to find.
We're like on the side of the road, by the side of the road.
It smells like pine.
Barely visible little bricks marking 82 graves in the middle of a forest on the side of a road in the quiet Louisiana countryside.
You know, there's this initial feeling of disappointment that I had, which is kind of giving way to like this feeling of wonder, because it's this just tiny patch that's covered in dead leaves and pine cones, surrounded by trees, and just every direction you turn, if you just kind of adjust your eyes, there are these little bricks standing up in rows across the entire patch of land. And then to kind of know that they're just unmarked slave graves just hidden here, just inside this forest, it's really kind of takes your breath away. But I think about this, and each of these 82 people only got this tiny brick. And we talk about all of the monuments in New Orleans and all across the South and America, and you just wonder, how does this fit in? Because this is history too. But no one's trying to save this history, except Mertis.
Find this history.
What's that?
So we can barely find this history. I mean, I don't think anybody had talked to her in years about this. And as far as I can tell, this is the only preserved slave cemetery in the state. I don't want this to be some big attraction. I think there's kind of a perversion in making this, yeah, and making it a tourist site. I mean, I feel like it's a cemetery and it's a place of remembering and respect and...
Yeah. It's not meant to compete with that history, is what you're saying.
No, and I think, I mean, I'm more moved by this than the slave museum we went to. I think part of the reason this is so powerful is it's quiet. You know, it's like even in death, the slaves were sort of overlooked.
We didn't want people showing up in tour buses, but we did think more people should see the graves, and that they shouldn't be so hard to find.
If anyone wants to see this place, it's actually quite easy to find. Just punch in the intersection of Lloyd Collins Road and Pitkin Road in St. Helena Parish, Louisiana. Skip all of Mertis's, take a left at the
Pipkin.
Pipkin. Lloyd Collins and Pipkin Road. Then maybe we'll just be good citizens and mark the grave on Google Maps as well. But
right,
it's...
How do I drop a pin here?
Rupa took out her phone and dropped a pin on the map.
Thank you for improving Google Maps. Thank you, Mertis.
And hopefully it stays there.
I think they've got to verify it.
Well, hopefully they come.
Hopefully they send a Google satellite over this place.
We spent the afternoon in the cemetery and then drove back down to New Orleans. Somehow, the graves made us feel more at peace with everything we'd seen. At the hearings in New Orleans, citizens gathered to say many of the same things we'd heard over the course of our trip. We even saw many of the same people. Malcolm was there, calmly waiting his turn to speak. Jason was there too, sitting in the back, heckling the opposition.
The Confederate monuments don't stand for white supremacy any more than the MLK monument stands for cheating on your wife. And let's not forget.
There was plenty of emotion, some cynicism, and more than enough provocation. But nobody was talking to each other. Nobody was trying to understand any perspective but their own.
After six grueling hours, two committees recommended to the council that the statues be taken down. But that certainly won't be the end of this story. The city council has yet to bring it to a vote, and several heritage groups are prepared to take them to court. We're relieved to head back to Africa to cover stories that don't hit so close to home. We're tired of staring our country's difficult history in the face. We're sick of the pain and the anger that it brings. Those who call the Confederacy heritage might be telling the truth, but if they are, they're ignoring the painful past that we all share as Americans. For the foreseeable future, the statues will stand, gazing down over the 300-year-old city and its strange brew of citizens.
That's Rupa Goganeni and Mike Onyego. Since we first released this episode in 2015, a lot has taken place in and out of New Orleans. As you might have heard, the New Orleans city government approved a plan for removing the four statues from the Crescent City. In his address announcing the removal, Mayor Mitch Landrieu said it's been a long and winding road to this point in history, marked by great tragedy and great triumph. And he referred to something that President George W. Bush said at the dedication of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Bush said, "A great nation does not hide its history. It faces its flaws and corrects them." And then Landrieu offered a rationale for why New Orleans chose to remove those four monuments to the lost cause of the Confederacy.
Our story. You see, we have not erased history. We're becoming part of the city's history by righting the wrong image these monuments represent and crafting a better, more complete future for all of our children and for future generations. And unlike when these Confederate monuments were erected as symbols of white supremacy, we now have a chance to create not only new symbols, but to do it together as one people. In our blessed land, we come to the table of democracy as equals. We have to reaffirm our commitment to a future where each citizen is guaranteed the uniquely American gifts of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is what really makes America great. And today, it's more important than ever to hold fast to these values and together say a self-evident truth that out of many, we are one. That is why we reclaim these spaces for the United States of America, because we are one nation, not two, indivisible with liberty and justice for all, not some. We are all part of one nation and pledge allegiance to one flag, the flag of the United States of America. And here's the kicker. New Orleanians are in it all of the way. It is in this union, it is in this truth, that real patriotism is rooted and it flourishes. Instead of revering a four-year brief historical aberration that was called the Confederacy, we can celebrate all 300 years of our rich, diverse history as a place named New Orleans and set the tone for the next 300 years.
You've been listening to Us and Them. Our show was written and produced by Rupa Goganeni and Mike Onyego, and I, Trey Kay, helped a little bit. Catherine Winter edited the program, and it was mixed by Mitch Hanley and Mike Onyego. Joni Deutsch is our digital producer. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. And special music for this report was composed and produced by Matthew Jackford and Joseph Savalos. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. Special thanks to Trevor Snapp, Justin Wood, and Scott Finn. If you like this program, let us hear from you on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Us Them Podcast, or directly to me at Trey_K. And ratings and reviews on iTunes really help people become more aware of our show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.